Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 115.
So I've told you already, I'm not getting excited by numbers anymore.
People need to know.
No, I think we should abandon numbers.
All right, people, you can suggest what we say. Say this is episode...
It's episode...
Triangle.
It's episode A. I'm starting a whole new system.
Right. At A, at 115.
Yep. No, we're starting from scratch.
Or is it just like the birth of Jesus Christ? All the episodes before that, they go backwards.
We're counting down. Who knows what's going
to
happen?
So what are we getting to?
Back to 114.
This is very confusing, Nick.
I have no idea what's going on.
It's too hot to be this confused. But how are you, Nick?
I'm confused.
Confused and hot.
Confused and hot.
Sticky.
No, not so much.
I'm sticky.
That's nice.
Wanted you to know that.
Good. It's always nice when you're across the table from me going, I'm sticky.
I've listened back to the episodes and I say very weird things to you some weeks. I just go, one time I went, I'm all salty, my skin's salty, because I've been swimming in the sea, but you had no context. And you were like, what?
I rarely have context when you're involved.
Yes, you're the voice inside my head. Isn't this what this is? You're my conscience.
I'm not here at all.
Any poisonings this week?
The people outside my house.
Keep away, children.
It's like, you know, when you get ants. And you put like a thing of ant powder and salt and stuff in a big circle around things.
You are making it sound like a ritual.
Yes, well, I'm going to do that around the front of my house. The white powder this time will be us, Nick, in a big circle around my house. Going, keep away!
And there's just a constant arsenic alarm, arsenic alarm outside the house, just ringing.
Constant that this is okay alarm. When it stops, beware.
Good. Okay. You're in a jolly mood. I like it. Well, speaking of keeping people away from your house, using things that you find in your kitchen, like salt and arsenic. And being sticky in front of your friends, but telling them about it, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious Patreon subscribers.
Yes. Thank you very much this week to Rose Bay Tea.
Ah, Rose Bay Tea. Very clever.
Are you sticky? Inquiring minds need to know.
Thank you, Rose Bay Tea. You are delicious. You're a very, very sexy Patreon subscriber. Thank you to all of our Patreon subscribers. We've had fun this week. Oh, we've been telling more tales of alleged crimes by Francois Courvoisier. Oh, we delved into that, a mystery, which was quite intriguing.
Yes, it was.
Patreons as well are getting treated to a lovely live chat this weekend. So an exclusive for our existing Patreons on Sunday evening, GMT. And we're also going to be answering some questions about new tiers that we are bringing into Patreon. All will be revealed very, very soon. We're also going to do a little shout out this week. A little shout out to Jennifer Corcoran. Now, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Via the delicious Kylie Kinyon, who is a big fan of ours. Jennifer listens to the show and has an amazing taxidermy mouse with arsenic. She's called it Arsenic Gordon.
That's very good.
That's very, very good.
I want one. Where do I get one? So let me know where I can get one of those.
Jennifer, thank you so much for immortalizing Nick in mouse poisony form.
And I have to find one. And that'd be great in the cabinet. Little taxidermy mouse. Cup and saucer with some poison.
You're into taxidermy, are you?
Not especially.
But now you are.
Now I am.
Well, we'll share a picture of the taxidermy mouse because it is most fabulous. We'd love to see more pictures that anyone wants to send in
of all your taxidermy.
I was just thinking, I don't know, props, anything you want to do, posed with poison, whatever you can think of, send it in. We love to see them. Some of you may have noticed, depending when you're listening to this episode, that we now have some advertising at the start and the end of the show. There will be an advert maybe appearing in the middle of each episode. The adverts that we have do help to generate revenue that supports the show, helps us do what we do. Please feel free to give us feedback about the ads. All Patreon subscribers get every episode ad-free. If ads really aren't your thing, then that's the place to be. Well, Nick, are you ready to drink cocktails and talk about poison? Or...
I knew there was more.
Option B, drink poison. Talk about cocktails. What will it be?
Is that you and your William Shatner, sort of?
What's it going to be, Nick?
anything, if you just stop that, I think. Okay, let's have a drink.
Okay, should we go with the first one?
Yes, fine.
Hooray! Hooray, hooray, hooray. We're going to go with the first one. It is Nick's story this week, and as you know, we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. Every week, dear listeners, we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell, and it will flavour our cocktail of the week. Nick's story this week... His pick for the ingredient.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, I'm just going to hark back to last week's where you gave me shit for a person named Courvoisier.
Yeah.
You were like, nope, nope, disappointing. It's not good enough. This week's secret ingredient, Nick, is...
It's the number 10.
The number
10.
Because we are now sponsored by Sesame Street.
Ten mois.
And also, massive shout out to the people on Instagram who went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
That was very good. I enjoyed that.
And that's been in my head all week, rent free. The number 10.
The number 10.
The number 10.
The magical number 10.
Now, are we thinking the number 10 Downing Street?
We'll find out, won't we?
Ooh, a prime ministry murder.
No, but possibly.
Oh, we're going to do that at some point. I know there's cocktails that are named number 1, number 2, number 3. Casinos. And
there are casinos.
There. Yeah.
There are corpse revivers.
Corpse revivers.
There are blood... Is it bloodhounds?
Bloodhounds, yeah.
That have numerical numbers.
I'm worried that there's a number 10 corpse reviver and how insane will we go?
Yeah. Mm. Unfortunately, it's not that.
Okay.
If there is a corpse reviver number 10... I'm yet to discover it. Perhaps I just invented everything in there.
I think the person who invented it is probably buried somewhere now. Well, with the number 10 as your ingredient or inspiration, what have you come up with?
Okay. Now.
Oh, don't. If you start with now, I know there's a long-winded story which will not please me.
The number 10 is fine. We like the number 10. It's a good number. One of the best numbers out there. I can multiply by 10. It's fine. There are a limited number of cocktails with the number 10.
Right.
Because people generally don't get that far in the cocktail numbering. I'm going to say this cocktail that we're going to make sounds very exciting. I'm looking forward to this cocktail.
Okay.
The name is Shite.
Is it called the Shite? What?
No, it's called Lemonade number 10.
Lemonade number 10?
Yeah.
Oh, that is a terrible name.
It's a terrible name. But it's an interesting cocktail. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm like that. You know, you got a crap name. cocktail could be interesting.
You are explaining, going, there's not many things out there called number 10. You literally chose this ingredient.
Yeah, well, to say 10 works. It works well with the episode. You know, we've got to link it with the episode. Remember that bit?
Yes, that too. Again, when it's my cocktail and I send you ingredients, you go, we're not doing that, going, but it links to the episode, going, I don't care.
It's no fun for me.
The lemonade number 10 sounds intriguing. Sounds like some sort of upgrade on the lemonade you sell on a street corner for 10 cents.
10 cents lemonade, yeah.
Or a refreshing lemonade on a hot summer's day.
Yep. No booze, just lemonade.
You know what? Maybe we could use it because you have just necked 2 glasses of wine.
Yes, I have.
And I fear this is going to degenerate. Yay! Ooh, drunk episode. Well, I think it is high time for us to skip into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm, so we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
So, Nick, lemonade number 10.
Yes.
Now, this is a tall drink of water.
Tall drink.
Now, this is many layers.
Oh, yeah. Yours is darker than mine. What's going on there?
Is it? It's a little bit darker. Yeah, so this is, it's in a very tall highball glass.
It is.
So it's got something red and smushy at the bottom. Red and smushy. Then it's sort of, there's a layer of something. I don't know what it is. And then it sort of pales into sort of more of a fizzy, peachy, icy thing. Yeah. And then it's got a kind of a questionable foamy head on mine.
Yours has got a questionable
foamy. Mine's got a questionable foamy head. Yours doesn't have that. What did you put in mine?
I had to make them in two batches.
So yes.
Yours has been left longer, I think, essentially.
It's let to rot, to apparently. Rot.
Yes.
It looks very tall and refreshing. It looks nice. I'm worried about the foamy head. But yeah, there's a lot going on. But I'm got a big spoon.
I'm going to give mine a bit of a stir just to incorporate the mini layers because it has sort of separated in the waiting.
Well, I might try mine without stirring and then I'm going to stir because I'm intrigued. So, noisy stirring and stirring. Nick's throwing ice everywhere.
A lot of ice.
Okay, so you've stirred yours. I haven't stirred mine yet. But okay, Merry Christmas. Let's dive in. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stir mine because mine tastes of nothing.
There is definitely something in there.
It needs a good stir. Now mine's separated. I don't think it was supposed to have the layers that I saw. Okay, I'm stirring. So now it's a really nice kind of rose sort of peach colour. Ooh, yes, perfect for a summer's eve. Okay, right now I'm diving in.
Yeah, now yours is a lot darker than mine.
Oh, okay, yeah, there's more stuff going on there. Well, there's more citrus, so I'm getting fruit.
Fruitiness.
Oh, it's nice. It's got a soda water. It's got soda water
in it. It's got some soda water in there.
Soda water's topped up. So it just sort of feels like a spritzer, really. Not with wine, but...
Not with wine.
Something fruity, something... I can't smell anything on there. There's a very faint hint of alcohol, I think. But yeah.
There is an ingredient never before had on the poisonous cabinet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can't taste it. Is it air?
Yes, I've injected air into this cocktail.
It's really nice. It's a really refreshing drink. It's making me think, have you just made us a non-alcoholic drink because sanity had to prevail at some point?
There is definitely alcohol.
No, yes.
And blueberries.
Blueberries?
Blueberries.
Blueberries, it's pink.
Yes.
Do you know what blueberries are?
Yes.
Did you confuse them with raspberries and you've never been willing to admit that you don't know what fruits are?
The packet said blueberries.
The packet said blueberries. Were you drunk when you bought it? It's actually beef. I mean, that would be pink. Blueberries. Okay. All right. Well, talk us through it then. This is intriguing.
Yeah. So blueberries. Actual blueberries in the bottom of your shaker. Smashy, smashy, smash.
Smashy, smashy, smash.
Perhaps more blueberries. Perhaps you had extra juicy blueberries in yours because yours is definitely a darker hue.
It's pink. It's not purple like blueberries should be.
Well, there's other things in there. But it has been watered down somewhat with the other ingredients. So it's not just pure glass of blueberry juice.
I was wondering, yes.
So we have blueberries. Uh-huh. We have some lemon juice.
Lemonade.
Some rum.
Rum.
Some lovely rum.
Ooh.
A bit of sugar.
Okay.
Shaky, shaky, shaky.
Shaky.
Chopped up with soda water.
Oh, okay.
That's basically a blueberry daiquiri with soda water.
Oh, the thing we haven't had is blueberries.
Then we had, yeah, we had.
Oh, right. I was like, what sort of mystery alcohol is in this?
No, blueberries. We've not had blueberries.
We've not had blueberries. See, I wouldn't say this is a blueberry daiquiri. I think this is like a, what would you call it? Like a cooler or what are the sort of like long ice drinks? You know, you've got Long Island iced tea. I'm not saying this right, but...
You're not, because it's nothing like a Long Island
iced tea. No, it's not like a Long Island iced tea, but where we've got... I don't know, is there a word or is there
a
name?
Nice long drink.
Is there a name for a long drink that is...
A long drink?
Just that. Okay. But like a Long Island iced tea. I wasn't far off.
A very nice, refreshing... I think there is a twang of fruitiness going on in there.
That's very, very nice for a summer drink.
See, on the roll with a summery loveliness.
Yeah, a picture of that.
Yeah.
Perfect on a summer's day.
Summer afternoon with a barbecue.
I know we say it a lot, saying, mix this up for friends. But you'll have some rum, blueberries, lemon juice, sugar, soda water. Oh, that's tasty.
Good, I like that.
Oh, that's good. That's cooled me right down.
I'm glad.
That's eased the stickiness.
Nice.
It's now just a dampness.
Oh.
Well, I would sell that for 10 cents outside and probably be arrested.
Probably.
With our lemonade number 10s firmly in hand as we sit out on the magical floating veranda. Is it time for a story, Nick?
Most certainly it is.
Hooray!
This week we're going to Wales. We start in Wales.
Wales!
Where we meet Timothy Evans.
Okay.
Timothy was born in 1924 in Merthyr Tydfil.
That's a good Welsh name.
Good Welsh place, good Welsh name. Now, his father ran off before he was born. No. And he grows up with his mother and his two sisters.
Okay.
Now, he suffers from a fair amount of health issues as a child. Yeah. Also seems to miss a lot of school. And he never really learns to read or write properly. Not the brightest spark in the box. Now, in 1935, his mother remarries and moves to London. with her new husband.
Fancy.
Now, Timothy, who's only 11 at this time, he decides, or it is decided for him, that he will stay in Merthyr Tydfil.
What
now,
year is this?
This is 1935.
Not even a war on.
Not even a war on at that point. And even at such a young age, it was decided by those around him that Timothy was really not destined for academia. That was not where he was going to end up.
That's a bad family do, isn't it? You're not going to college. I'm five.
Yeah, any further education would probably just be a bit wasted, really, on the young lad. They did the only thing that they could do at the time, and they sent him down the coal mines.
Oh, God.
That's what you do. You go down the pits.
Oh, no. Now I'm thinking about pit ponies, and I don't like it.
He survived, and he down the pits for about 2 years. Before his continuing his ill health issues were slightly exacerbated by breathing in lumps of coal all day, it forces him to quit. Before he cannot continue with life down the mines.
I was going to say, if you've got a sickly child, maybe don't send them into a dark pit of coal dust.
Full of coal dust, no, absolutely, and explosions and all manner of unpleasant
things. The explosions are also not very good
for
your health.
They are not good for your health. And with no other options, in 1939, he moves to London to live with his mother in Notting Hill.
Oh, lovely, but also very badly timed.
But also, now you think of today, of Notting Hill, as all lovely. It's all very pleasant and full of lovely things, rich people and expensive people. 1940s Notting Hill is not quite so nice.
Yeah.
It is a very unpleasant place. It's run down, it's seedy. Yeah, hookers on every millimetre of the street. It is full of crime and vice, and it's not much more than a slum, really. It's not a jolly place to be.
Ooh.
But he is in London. Everyone wants to be in London. The streets are paved with gold, they say. And there he can pretty much be who he wants to be. He can reinvent himself. And even at this really rather young age, he's only in his teens by now, he needs to know that he needs to fit in. He would tell elaborate stories of his youth, his time down the mines. You know, he was a hardened Welshman. He switched back and forth between Welsh and London accents. Whatever would really help him fit in with the group he was with at the time.
Ways to woo the women.
But it does seem that he is going to do whatever it takes, really, to be what other people wanted him to be.
We've all been there.
Well, quite. But have you been here? On one occasion, he was fined 60 shillings for stealing a car and driving without a license or insurance. He said it was fine. It was a friend's car. His friend has asked him to pick up the car and bring it to him. It was not his friend's car.
Do I have to answer that?
Have you ever done that
before?
Have you been thieving cars and being fined 60 shillings?
Not been thieving cars.
He was far too trusting, far too innocent for the likes of London.
Ugh.
In January 1946, Timothy Evans meets Beryl Thorley after being set up on a blind date.
Oh, Beryl. There's not enough Beryls these days.
No, well, indeed. But they obviously hit it off and they are married by September that year. The newlywed couple move in with mum and stepdad in Notting Hill. Now, in 1948, Beryl falls pregnant and the pair decide that they really should get their own place. Now, property in London is not easy to find. By this time, say, we're looking sort of late 40s, most of the houses have been blown to bits during the Blitz.
It's not a good job for an estate agent. This is lovely. It's got a wonderful breeze.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through it.
We've got a lovely skylight here. Yeah. So houses are not easy to find and people are crammed in on top of each other. Even more so in the slum areas like Notting Hill. It says, get everyone in as much as possible. But then Timothy and Beryl are delighted when they find a little flat nearby. Just a few minutes walk from Timothy's mum. It's perfect.
Oh, nice.
So in the summer of 1948, Timothy and Beryl Evans moved into 10 Rillington Place.
Oh, God. I didn't see it coming. Oh, Nick, you did that so well. Because I was just sitting going, what is this story about? What is this lovely tale of domestic bliss? No! Damn it, old boy.
So you're familiar with 10 Rillington Place?
I know of it. I've heard of it because of the films and there's
Absolutely.
A podcast and all sorts of things about it. Actually, I've never researched the story. It was on the list to go, ooh, must look into this one.
One that's been on the list from the very beginning
yes.
of doing this.
Never have seen anything about it, so I am actually coming
you
to this
film?
As a newbie. No.
Yeah. So nope. 1971, Richard Attenborough, John Hurt, very fancy film, very good film.
I don't think we said fancy because it had fancy people in it.
It had fancy people in it, but it's a very good film.
They weren't fopping around in fancy clothes going, I'll kill you.
They really weren't. but as I said, there have been books and TV series and podcasts and all sorts of shenanigans about 10 Rillington Place. It's one of the most famous addresses in London.
Da-da-da.
Now, the house is split into two flats. Timothy and Beryl have the top floor flat, while the ground floor flat is the home of Ethel and John Christie. And they're a perfectly pleasant couple, a bit older than Timothy and Beryl. John Christie is a post office clerk, but he had been a police officer during the war, so he's obviously a trustworthy sort. Now, Timothy and Beryl's relationship is a slightly volatile one. They argue frequently, they struggle financially, and when baby Geraldine comes along in 1948, it really only puts a greater strain on the marriage. Timothy accuses Beryl of being a poor housekeeper, of not being able to manage the family finances. Timothy, on the other hand, drank most of his wages, so there were no finances to manage.
Yeah. She never cooks, she never cleans, she keeps a filthy house.
Indeed.
And she talks profanely.
Now all his drinking probably only exacerbates his short temper. The arguments increase. They are loud enough to be heard by neighbours up and down the street, and they are often commented upon around the water pump.
Oh dear.
In 1949, Beryl Evans gets pregnant yet again. It is not the happy news that one might expect, and even though it is illegal at the time, Beryl decides that the only real sensible course of action is for her to get an abortion.
Risky. No judgment, but risky.
Very, very risky, absolutely. Cut to several weeks later.
Okay.
30th of November, 1949. Timothy Evans enters a police station in Merthyr Tydfil, saying that he is worried for the safety of his 18-month-old daughter, Geraldine.
Okay.
The police ask why he is worried. Where is the child's mother? He tells them that his wife, Beryl, is dead.
Uh-huh.
And he actually says that she has died under unusual circumstances. Now, all the reports I've read on this actually say, he says, unusual circumstances. Which is a bit of a strange thing to say when you're going to a police station.
Unusual circumstances. Da, da, da. Why are you saying that? Drama.
Yeah. I think this potentially is a slightly dramatic license put on by various reporters. He can hardly read and write, this man. This sort of piques the interest of the police. And they ask, well, what circumstances? And his confession comes flooding out.
Ooh.
His wife had been pregnant and they didn't want to keep the baby. He says that he had gone to some unknown quack druggist and been given a concoction that he had been assured would do the job. All she had to do was drink this.
Beryl was had, it a pint of gin?
We do not know what the concoction contained. Beryl had drunk the liquid. Within hours, was dead.
Oh, dear.
Timothy, he says he was distraught, but he can't go to the police in London and claim an accident. Abortion is illegal. So instead, he's taken his wife's body and stuffed it down the drain outside.
What?
He has then arranged for his daughter to be looked after by some friends and has fled to Wales, where his guilty conscience has overcome him and he has presented himself to the police.
It's a way of dealing with a situation.
It's an option.
Okay, I'll go with it.
So the police in Wales contact their London counterparts and they ask if they wouldn't mind popping along to 10 Rillington Place to see if there's any truth in this. Is it true or is he just a madman off the street? Is there indeed a body down the drain? The London police find nothing.
What?
It takes three of them to lift off the drain cover.
Yeah.
And if Timothy had indeed put his wife's body down there, he would have certainly needed help. But there is no evidence that this thing has been lifted off in months, if not years.
Okay.
So what the hell is he talking about? Back in Wales, the police confront him. There is no body down the drain. What are you playing at? He then changes his story.
Right.
In the next telling, he introduces John Christie, the man in the downstairs flat.
Yeah.
He says that John has overheard them, one of their arguments, one of their discussions about the abortion, about the pregnancy, and that Christie has offered to perform the abortion himself. And that the couple then decided to take him up on this offer. Timothy continues. He says that on the 9th of November, he had returned from work, and John Christie told him that Beryl had died during the procedure, but that he shouldn't worry, he would take care of it all.
Don't worry, your wife's dead.
Don't worry, your wife's dead.
But I'm going to take care of
this illegal procedure.
I'll sort it. It's not a broken teapot.
No.
It's a dead wife.
In this version of events, Timothy says that John Christie told him that he should leave London. He would dispose of the body and he would arrange a nice couple in East Acton to look after Geraldine.
That does sound like, I know a farm, two towns over.
Evan said that he agreed. So, as we say, he's not the brightest spark. He is a very naive, trusting sort of man.
Yeah.
This man who is obviously more intelligent, more articulate, was in the police, heir of authority. Timothy does what he is told, really.
Right.
And he does. He goes to stay with relatives in Wales. But he returns about a week and a half, 10 days later, to try and see what has happened to his daughter. He wants to know what's happened to Geraldine, but Christie refuses to let him see Geraldine. She's better off where she is with this new family. You should just forget about her. She's better off where she is now. Now, after this second confession, the Welsh police are back on the phone once again to London. I know you've just been round, but would you mind heading back to Rillington Place and have another search? Perhaps have a chat with this Christie guy downstairs, see if there's anything going on there, any truth to this. Now, this time the search is somewhat more thorough of the whole property, not just the drain outside and the flat. They go through the whole property. Mm. And under a bundle of cloth in the wash house behind 10 Rillington Place, they find the bodies of both Beryl and Geraldine Evans, wrapped in a tablecloth. Both had been strangled to death. Now, after this discovery, Timothy is returned to London from Merthyr Tydfil. And there the police confront him about what they have found in the wash house, his wife and daughter, both dead. He seems entirely distraught at the news of his daughter.
Yeah.
So he knew his wife was dead, but he had no idea about his daughter. And he genuinely seems absolutely bereft. When the police ask him, is he responsible for this? He simply replies, yes.
What? Well, Evans does.
Evans does. They ask him, are you responsible for the death of your wife and daughter? He just says, yes.
Wow.
Now, that's all the police need to hear, really. It doesn't matter that his two other confessions make no sense. His two other statements are complete fairy tales, really. He has now said yes. That's all they need to hear. Timothy Evans is charged with murder.
What's going on? I'm sorry. I've never heard this story, so yes, this is live, people. Never seen the film. What's going on? What's happening? I'm not... What?
A man has just been charged with the murder of his wife and daughter.
After making up two completely strange stories.
After making up two strange stories.
This is not a story for lemonade. You set this up as a lovely, charming story. And there's lemonade and I'm not happy. Give me some of that wine, Nick. This is a wine episode.
Go on, then. The trial starts on the 11th of January in 1950.
Okay.
Now, as was the style of the time, he was put on trial for one murder.
Yes.
That of Geraldine, the daughter. And after speaking with his solicitor who had been appointed, Timothy had since recanted his previous confessions.
Okay.
And pleaded innocent once he had this new advice.
The lawyer's like, trust me. Stop it.
Yeah.
Stop saying shit.
And he's pleading innocent. He still claims that John Christie is, in fact, the true murderer, the chap from downstairs. Now, Christie takes the stand as a key witness, but for the prosecution. Of course, he hadn't murdered his neighbours or offered an abortion. He wasn't a doctor. He wouldn't do any such thing. What nonsense. What motive could he possibly have? He and his wife, Ethel, they're both on the stand, and they both report, though, the loud, occasionally violent arguments they hear from the couple upstairs. In rebuttal, though, the defence reveal that John Christie is not quite as squeaky clean as he makes himself out to be.
No.
He has old convictions for theft.
Okay.
And had even once served 6 months in prison for hitting a woman with a cricket bat.
What? What sort of play was he in? What sort of farcical comedy? Hit a woman with a cricket bat.
And he was sentenced to 6 months hard labour in Wandsworth Prison for the assault.
Jesus Christ, he's a bastard. I know it's difficult when you don't hit a six, but still, don't take it out on a woman.
Christie, he replies, this was all long, long ago, he says. He is a reformed character. He had been a special constable during the war. He could bring character witnesses to show that what a respectable man he was these days. Yes, he had made mistakes in his youth and he had paid for them, but now he was an upstanding member of society.
Yes, he's learned not to hit people with cricket
bats. Hard labor, 6 months hard labor, I'll do that to you, I feel.
It's good that he needed that. Really.
In the end, though, it comes down to who the jury believe more.
Yes, that is the point of a trial, Nick.
Yeah, but Timothy, it's Timothy or John. Timothy, who is quiet, he's meek, he's not very bright or articulate, versus John, who is quite charming, he's persuasive, he's respectable, he's been a police officer. Served during the First World War, he was a police officer in the Second World War. Who are they going to believe most?
Well, they're going to believe Christie.
The trial lasts 3 days. The jury takes just 40 minutes to declare Timothy Evans guilty. And on the 9th of March 1950, Timothy Evans is hanged for the murder of his daughter, Geraldine.
Wow.
And that's the end of our story.
Okay.
No, it's not.
What?
There might be a bit more. And now it's time for wine.
This is a point where we pause for wine and maybe an advertising break.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, we have wine.
We have wine.
Second part of the story.
Are you ready to continue? Are you
braced? I don't know. I'm going to hold both my drinks very close to me.
So what's going on with that John Christie? What about dear old John? Well, he's been a key witness in this sensational trial. It has been huge amounts of press. But a lot of stuff is revealed that he would have rather preferred remained hidden and in his past. He loses his job at the post office as a result of his criminal conviction being made public. And he does struggle to find a new job, sort of having to go between odd jobs here and there where he can find them. His wife leaves him. His wife goes. Oh. She's gone to Sheffield, he says. She has gone to stay with family. By 1953, he is desperate and he can no longer afford to rent his flat. The money is just not there. So he comes up with a bit of a plan. He starts subletting his flat,
okay.
But he pockets the money, renting it to another couple. They're giving him the cash. That cash is going in his pocket.
Because he's renting, he doesn't own it.
Yeah, exactly. He rents it. That money, the money he's getting is not going to the landlord. On the 20th of March 1953, he does a runner. He leaves Rillington Place with the rent money that he's received. £7.13.
Oh, a handsome sum.
Yeah, a handsome sum of about 300 quid today. So it's not going to get you far.
No.
You're not going to be able to start a new life.
Oh, I tell you.
On this.
Wouldn't get you far in today's money.
Indeed.
No. That'd get you a latte. Yeah. Maybe.
Maybe.
Now that again, London. Why are we doing Northern accents?
Now that very evening, the landlord turns up at the house for the rent. And he discovers this sort of unknown, this unknown couple living in the house. And he's like, who the fuck are you? Okay, well, we live here. It's my fucking house. So he boots them out that night.
Oh.
Get out of my house. And the very next day, the tenants from the upstairs flat, the one that Timothy and Beryl had previously lived in, they moved downstairs. It's much larger. It's a bit of a nicer flat. The landlord says, yeah, come on down. The rent's going up, but come on downstairs.
Ooh,
and
nice.
The next day, they move into the downstairs apartment. Apparently, the landlord does not hold much hope for Christie to turn up again. And he just needs to get the rent coming in.
He'll take what he can get. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Now, a few days later, we're now on the 24th of March. These new tenants downstairs decide to do a bit of DIY in the kitchen. They want to put up a new shelf. They've got a new radio, a new wireless set. They need a new shelf for their wireless. Now, as the chap...
They're really putting some investment in this shelf, aren't they?
Absolutely.
They're all jealous of the shelf and down the street.
There's a lovely spot on the wall for this shelf to go for this radio. It's perfect, perfect spot for a radio.
How big is the radio?
As the chap goes and he's attempting to fit these brackets to the wall that is going to hold this shelf, he discovers there is no wall.
It's a fake wall.
It's a thin layer of paper.
What?
Covering a hidden alcove.
Oh, God.
The chap rips down this paper.
No.
Revealing a small pantry area that's been sort of, papered over.
Okay.
Inside, he uncovers the bodies of three women.
What?
the women are later identified as Kathleen Maloney, Rita Nelson, and Hectorina McLennan.
Excellent names, but also...
Also, three women papered over in the pantry.
In the pantry?
In the pantry of the downstairs flat.
God, I thought he was just hiding his snacks.
Nope.
Hiding
dead bodies.
I mean, I could see it going in this direction. It's that much of a famous story. I was like, oh, there's bodies somewhere, isn't there? You don't like it.
Now, unsurprisingly, the new chap is slightly terrified by his discovery.
I don't think it's the sort of DIY job where you stand there going, oh, yeah, there's bodies in here.
Bodies in there.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get my brother in to put, you know, sort of an iron girder kind of protection around this.
He does actually go to the neighbour next door, get the neighbour next door and goes, is that what I think they are?
I get that.
Are they real dead people?
I am seeing this right. I'm not going mad,
I'm
right?
I'm hallucinating all of this.
Yeah. I need you to share in this trauma with me. Yeah. You're in it for the long run now, pal.
So this other chap goes, oh, yes, they are dead people. Yeah, we should probably contact the authorities about this. We should probably get the police involved.
Oh, God.
So the police quickly arrive. They are familiar with the address. Over the past few years, they've made a few visits to 10 Rillington Place, and they pretty much tear the place apart in their searching. In the garden, they find two more skeletons, one with a skull missing. Again, in the garden, propping up a trellis on the fence, it's a thigh bone, just used to hold up the garden panels, the rose trellis.
No one spotted this.
No. And the police had been there searching the garden when they discovered they discovered the beryl. In the wash house. They'd been through the garden. They'd searched that. Yeah. The bone had been propping up the trellis all that time. They just didn't notice it.
You wouldn't see it for looking, though, would
you? Well, there is that.
Yeah.
They should have been looking harder, I feel.
Largest bone in the human body, the femur.
Well, there we go. And very good for propping up a trellis.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Actually, if you're going to use a bone.
Under the floorboards, they find the remains of Ethel Christie.
Ethel's in there.
She wasn't in Sheffield after all.
Oh.
She's under the floorboards. Now, the hunt is on for John Christie.
You would think.
At this point, they go, ooh, this is not right. We must find this man.
another fantastic noise from the police.
Another fantastic noise. Ooh.
Hang on. What sort of noise? We're looking through our book. What noise does this denote? Okay, we need... Ooh. Someone screaming in the background going, you're going over the top.
Now, after John has done his runner from Rillington Place, it turns out he has taken a room at a lodging house in King's Cross. But as soon as the news of the discoveries in Notting Hill broke, he ran.
Of course.
He left the lodging house. His name and his face are in all the papers throughout London, now throughout the country, really, and everyone is on the lookout for this man. But he stays in London. He wanders the streets of London. He sleeps rough. He spends the next few days in cafes and cinemas, places like that, where he can keep a low profile. On the 28th of March, he is spotted pawning his watch in Battersea for 10 shillings. So they know he is still in London.
Mm-hmm.
On the morning of the 31st of March, Christie is arrested on the embankment near Putney Bridge after being challenged about his identity by a police officer.
Good for
him. So police has gone, oi, you, this is a Sergeant George Judd.
George Judd.
Has spotted him.
Also, excellent impression of a London bobby. Oi, you, oi, come over here. What's all this in?
What's all this? Now, when he is searched, among his personal items that he has in his wallet, they discover an old newspaper clipping about the execution of Timothy Evans.
Kept in his wallet. That's horrible.
Yeah. The police now have this man in custody, and they have many, many bodies in his house, in his garden, under his floor. But who is John Christie, they think? What is going on with this man? He had always seen... They'd interviewed this man before.
Yeah.
With the Timothy Evans case. They had interviewed him. They had questioned him.
Yeah.
He had been on stand in court. He
and
had always
picked apart his past and that he has crimes and that he was...
It always seemed so, mild-mannered, quiet. Yes, he had this past, but it seemed to be in the past. But as they dig deeper, they find a fiercely intelligent man, but a deeply, deeply psychologically scarred man.
Okay.
So he had fought in the First World War, but he had been injured in a mustard gas attack on the front, and he had spent months in a field hospital in Calais recovering. Now, Christie later claimed that this attack had left him permanently unable to speak loudly, which is why he was so quiet. His voice had been reduced to that of pretty much no more than a whisper. Doctors were not able to find any physical reason to why his voice was so quiet, and many believe that it was a psychological reaction to the attack, which stemmed from an underlying personality disorder. It caused him to exaggerate or feign illnesses to gain sympathy and gain attention. It was an affectation, but it's one he couldn't control, really. His very sort of whispery voice. Okay. Now, police uncovered more of the criminal record that had been brought to light at the Evans trial. They discovered that there had been frequent cautions about his visits to prostitutes in the past.
Stop that now.
Oops. Put it away. In 1921, he had been jailed for stealing postal orders while working as a postman. In 1923, he had been jailed yet again for obtaining money under false pretenses and for violent conduct. In 24, he was jailed yet again for theft. Then in 1929, he was sentenced to the 6-month hard labour for the assault on Maud Cole with the cricket bat that we had mentioned earlier.
No one thought to look into this. No. The first time round, they were like, he gives his side of the story and just gives a couple of convictions. They go, I have no reason to question you at all. The file's right here. Yeah, that just feels like reading.
Yeah, I mean, in the Evans case, he was very much, he was a witness in that. No one suspected him of anything.
But the defence should do it. The defence should look into the witnesses. Surely that's what you do. I mean, you don't want to tear them apart completely, but you do make sure that the prosecution witnesses are credible, will do no work here whatsoever.
Well, no, they did, and they're the ones who highlighted that he had convictions in the past. It was the defence who, at the Evans trial, they're the ones who brought this up.
Yeah, but it looks like they looked at one thing and didn't read the rest of the file. Someone was like, there is a lot more in here. Wow. No, I've got my one thing. Really?
Would it have made much difference? Who knows?
Yes, I'm going to say yes.
Really? Okay. In 1934, he has married Ethel. Now, they had been on and off for several years prior to that, but she does seem to have a bit of a stable effect on John. So when he gets out of prison for his most recent dalliances with the law, they get married. Things seem to calm down. He settles down. He starts working at the Commodore Cinema in Hammersmith.
Oh.
Very civilised. And when the Second World War breaks out, he joins the Reserve Police and was assigned to Harrow Road Police Station. Unfortunately, there he meets Gladys Jones and the two begin to have an affair, which is less good. Now, this lasts till 1943 when her soldier husband comes home and discovers Christie in bed with his wife. The soldier is not too pleased with this homeming gift, really. And
honey, I'm home. Honey, what I'm home. The shit?
Yeah, and he beats the shit out of John.
Oh, good.
In the police station, Christie's life is laid bare before him, really. All this research, all this investigation they have done, they confront him with it. And he begins to talk. And he admits to the murders of the women in the pantry. But what about the bodies in the garden? Oh, yes, I killed them too.
Oh, yes, those two. Yes.
Christie is calm and steady as he reveals the details. After his affair with Gladys and the encounter with the husband, he returned to his habit of visiting prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
There are many reports that he had difficulties performing sexually with partners, and prostitutes were the thing that did it for him.
Mm.
But on the 24th of August 1943, he meets Ruth first at a snack bar in Ladbroke Grove. Christie invites her home. Ethel was visiting family at the time, so he had the place to himself. And as Ruth lay in bed, John strangles her with a length of rope and buries her body in the garden.
Why?
We don't know. He just says in his confessions that that's what he has done. There is conjecture later that he struggled to perform sexually.
This took a violent turn.
Whether she inadvertently said something that he then enraged him, yeah, and he just flipped out because he couldn't perform. But that is the prevailing thought about as to what triggered him.
A switch has flipped at this point.
Absolutely. Now, he soon resigns as a special constable. Policeman by day, murderer by night.
I'm sorry, I know I shouldn't laugh. First thing I should do, I should not be a special constable anymore.
I should not be a police officer.
I may be mad and a psychopath, but I have some foresight and a little bit of self-awareness here.
Yeah.
I'm digging the hole. Well, I am not going to be a policeman anymore. Jesus Christ.
Probably not an easy thing to pull off, yeah. So the two responsibilities there are somewhat different.
Well, he's chosen his path.
Oh, well, exactly, that he has. Now, after leaving the police, he gets a job at a radio factory in Acton. And there he meets his second victim, Muriel Edie. On the 7th of October 1944, he invites Muriel back to his flat. Now, this time he seems to have the promise that he has concocted a special mixture that will cure her bronchitis. Again, with a medical theme, sort of, I can cure you, I can fix you.
I'm sorry, I had a really filthy thought there, sorry.
No.
No. He's like, I'm like, oh, I'll cure you of your bronchitis with my penis.
No, I don't believe that's the way he went.
She might have been up for it, to be fair.
Well, she went back to a...
third play.
Yeah, a married man's flat.
Yeah, a married man's flat who's clearly not a doctor, who works at a radio factory. So, oh, I've got a cure for you back home, babe.
Yeah, but she is somewhat naively trusting and agrees to try this miracle cure. This cure is an inhalant, he says, and she has to inhale the mixture from this jar, got a tube coming out the top of it. Now, once Edie is seated and she is breathing in this mixture from this tube from this jar, she doesn't seem to notice another tube that sort of comes out of the same jar and sort of leads away somewhere over there under the counter.
What? She's just... Oh, no, you have a contraption. Sorry, no. I thought this was a euphemism, but fair enough,
apparently
I'm here.
Apparently not. No, she's...
Yeah, she's huffing away at a jar.
Huffing away at a jar. John goes and turns the gas on.
Jesus Christ.
Which goes through the tube into the jar, and Muriel's merrily puffing away.
Oh, Muriel.
Coal gas.
Muriel. Yeah. No. There needs to be a public service announcement right now. If someone invites you back to their house saying they have a miracle cure for bronchitis, don't go.
Also,
inhale in this tube in this weird jar. Don't do it. If that is their preamble.
It's very niche, if it is.
It's very niche. Poor Muriel.
Right, soon, Muriel is unconscious on the floor. Now, Christy does admit to sexually assaulting her. While she is unconscious.
Motherfucker.
And then after strangling her before burying her body alongside Ruth Furist in the garden.
Ugh.
Then he makes a confession that no one is expecting.
Okay.
Or perhaps one that they are fearing most of all, really.
It's Jack the Ripper.
He's confessed to murdering Beryl Evans, a crime for which her husband Timothy had been executed for 3 years earlier.
What a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Then came Ethel, his wife. Now, she must have known, or at least suspected, that her husband had become something quite monstrous.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, she had stood up in the dock at Timothy Evans' trial alongside her husband. Now, we do not know why John felt that Ethel had to go. But on the 14th of December 1952, John strangled his wife in bed.
She must have
buried her body under the floorboards. Whether she had threatened to leave him or threatened to go to the police about what she knew or what she suspected, we don't know. But he felt that she had to be silenced. Perhaps it was just to give him more free rein to continue what he liked without having to wait while she was out of the house or anything like that.
She could have known something. She could have known absolutely nothing.
Absolutely. But she had to go. Now, with Ethel out of the way, he does indeed have free rein to do as he pleased. He quits his job and starts living off her savings. And then when they run out, he starts selling her belongings, her wedding rings, her dresses, her jewellery, and that to get the cash he needs. Between the 19th of January and the 6th of March 1953, John Christie murders three more women that he invites back to 10 Rillington Place. Now, these are the three that end up in the hidden pantry. Kathleen Maloney was a prostitute from the Ladbroke Grove earlier. Rita Nelson was from Belfast, and she was visiting her sister in Ladbroke Grove.
Mm.
Hectorina McKellen was living in London with her boyfriend and had met John in a cafe, again in Ladbroke Grove, just around the corner. Now, for the murder of these final three victims, Christie seemed to modify the gassing technique that he had first used with Muriel Edie. This time, rather than get them to inhale on a jar, which is, as we said, is a very niche sort of thing, this time he uses a rubber tube connected to a gas pipe in the kitchen, which he sort of keeps closed off with a bulldog clip. And once his guest is comfortably seated in the kitchen, in the parlour, he just unclips the tube and the whole room fills.
Floods it with gas.
With coal gas. This is before they started adding a smell to gas.
I was just about to say that, and people will be going, it's the Friends line, isn't it? You know that smell? They add that in.
They add that in, absolutely.
Gas is odourless.
So yeah, it's mercaptan, is the chemical that they add to give it that sort of rotten eggs sort of smell. But this is way before they started doing that, which you think is 1950s. You think really quite recent. None the wiser until they started feeling drowsy and sleepy. And by that time, it was pretty much too late.
Too late.
Really. As the woman lay unconscious, John Christie strangles them to finish the job. Now, it is often questioned about how come he didn't succumb to these fumes in the property.
Very good point.
And to be honest, no one really knows the answer to that. But what they do confirm in the autopsy is that, yes, they have been asphyxiated. There is this gas in their lungs. How John managed to escape that, if he was wearing some sort of
gas mask,
or something.
Yeah.
He never admitted to anything like that, but that could be a way that he avoided the gas. Now, one confession, though, he never made was that of baby Geraldine. It was suspected that absolutely he was responsible for the infant's death, but it was also thought he never admitted, because he knew that if he admitted to killing a child, then he would be done for in the eyes of a jury. Absolutely done for. He was going to go for an insanity plea.
Right, okay.
But if he had killed a child, no matter if he was completely nuts, they were going to be after him.
Yeah.
And if he had admitted to that, he probably wouldn't last long in prison either.
No, exactly, as a child killer.
So that's the one thing that he constantly denied, that he had nothing to do with that. The trial of John Christie begins on the 22nd of June 1953 in the very same courtroom in which Timothy Evans had been tried 3 years earlier. Now, again, as was the style, he's only tried for one murder, that of his wife, Ethel.
Mm-hmm.
But the others are introduced as evidence. So the three dead bodies in the pantry, the two dead bodies in the garden are evidence that you probably did kill your wife who was under your floorboards.
Take these into consideration and all of that. Yeah, that's how the system works.
Well, and one is as good as as good as eight, really, in this one, because one's going to get you hanged. Now, Christie pleads insanity, with his defense describing as mad as a March hare. Now, Dr. Matheson, who's a doctor from Brixton Prison who has evaluated Christie, he is called by a witness for the prosecution, and he testifies, using the terminology of the time, that Christie had a hysterical personality, but he is not insane. Yes, he is ill. He is not insane. The jury rejects Christie's plea.
Good.
And after deliberating for 85 minutes, find him guilty of murder.
Hooray!
On July the 15th, 1953, the same man who hanged Timothy Evans, this is an Albert Pierpoint.
It's a Pierpoint
execution, hangs John Christie. Now, on the gallows, Christie complains that the noose is itchy. Pierpoint tells him, it's not going to bother you for long.
Yes.
before he drops. Now, after Christie's trial and the revelations about Beryl Evans' true killer, public support for capital punishment plummets. It's already pretty low at this point. It's a pretty controversial topic. So
very,
late
very
40s,
close, yeah.
50s. It's very controversial. In fact, in 1949, the year before Timothy had been executed, the House of Commons had a debate on capital punishment. And there it was declared that the only way an innocent man could conceivably be hanged would be if the police, the attorneys, the judge and the jury had all gone collectively mad. Only possible way this could happen. Now, this case has shown that to be complete bollocks.
Absolutely.
It was absolutely possible. However, it still takes another 12 years till the death penalty is first suspended in 1965 and then completely abolished for murder in 1969. It doesn't come off the statute books in the UK. It's about 1999.
No, it's or something. Really recent.
When it's like, you have to have, killed the Queen or something.
Yeah, treason was I remember talking about that at school, going, you can still be hanged for treason. Yeah,
not anymore, though.
Not anymore.
1969, it eventually came off the books for murder. In 1966, after two official inquiries, Timothy Evans receives a royal pardon.
Yay.
But his conviction is never quashed, because it was deemed that it was going to take too much time and too much money to do it. Now, many of the gloomy and rickety houses of Notting Hill were demolished over the years after the war.
Yes.
And the area has been heavily redeveloped and replaced with shiny new buildings and all the lovely things. But all that remains today is a small garden between two houses that marks where 10 Rillington Place once stood.
Wow.
And there we go. A very, very famous case that not many people have heard of. But you'll know the name.
10 Rillington.
10 Rillington Place.
Place. Oh, and the number 10, which I did not twig until the middle, way too late into that story,
How
Nick.
How did you not twig that?
Because I was so blown away that it was 10 Rillington Place. And I 10 Rillington Place. And then it wasn't until you said that Christie had bought something for 10 cents, like 10 shillings or something. I was like, 10. I was like, no, it's the bloody address, you stupid woman.
It's the address.
It's the bloody address. Oh, thank you so much for the story, Nick. So, a complete newbie here, as in knew the story but did not know the details, hadn't even started researching it and looked into it. So, really, I had no idea of any of that in there. What a story. Chilling.
Terrifying story.
Yeah, absolutely horrifying. Yeah. The question I have about Evans is, what is going on with all the false confessions and then him saying he's responsible?
I think, I don't know how to articulate what's in my head.
It's a difficult one where when you said that he said who was responsible? And yeah. Are you responsible? And he said, yes. Was he trying to say in a way that I think I'm responsible for this because I've left them alone and it's my fault?
Yes, I think that's probably very, very much what it is.
But he didn't kill them.
No, absolutely. He didn't kill them. He didn't kill either of them. And that is absolutely 100% true. He didn't kill either of them. And I think also he was a very naive, very trusting, not very clever man who had been completely taken in by someone who was persuasive, someone who was convincing, very intelligent, and had been made to believe or made to parrot a response. Because if you don't say this, then you're going to get in trouble.
I still don't understand that, unless there's a chunk that I'm missing. And fair play that, you know, we're all having wine here. We maybe, and you've just polished off the wine. Maybe I wanted some. No, it's fine.
There's more in the fridge.
Maybe we will open more bottles of wine and go over this. Evans, as you said, from the start of the story, if I'm remembering this correctly, he goes into the police station saying he's worried about his daughter.
Worried about his daughter.
And then he talks about this elaborate story that his daughter is in the equivalent of a farm two towns over. Then he says he's put his wife in the drain. Then he changes it. Why is Evans walking into a police station saying all of these lies and changing them and moving it around? That's bizarre to me.
It is. Absolutely. No, I agree. And I possible way I can think of explaining that potentially is that it is a series of lies that have been concocted by someone else that he has been told. If someone asks you, this is what you say.
So you think that Christy had either his wife and his daughter had gone missing. Christy basically told him, hey, if anyone asks you stuff, this is what's happened.
This is what's happened.
Or that Evans knew Christy had murdered them.
I think
it sounds insane.
It's bizarre because, I mean, during the trial, Evans is convinced Christy has done it, but he still keeps on down this line of this abortion, that John Christy had offered this abortion. Now, John Christy says that then they ask, why did you kill Beryl? He says he strangled them after they had sex. He actually says he and Beryl had been intimate, consensually so, and that apparently she had become so remorseful after this act that he helped her commit suicide was his line.
Yeah. Oh.
Which I'm not entirely convinced about either.
That doesn't help, Nick. That just makes a whole other mire of weirdness. The only thought I've just had is that did Christy say he was going to perform the abortion, killed her, then said to Evans, oh, she's died through the abortion. She's died and it's your fault. And it's your fault. I mean, I couldn't save her and you agreed to this abortion.
Yeah.
We're going to have to hide the body. And he says, oh, I'm going to hide it down the drain or I'm going to do this. The daughter, who knows?
The daughter has been strangled. It's proved in the postmortem that the daughter was strangled along with the mother. And that was done by, that must have been done by Christy. Mm. He has told Timothy Evans, who has been come back from Wales, says, I want to see my daughter. And Chrissy said, no, she's better off in East Acton with this other family. She is clearly dead and now in the washhouse with her mother.
He must just feel this responsibility, whatever so Christy has done.
Overwhelming responsibility for his family that he has, well, he feels that he has failed to look after them. And so are you responsible? Yes, I'm responsible for this. I agreed to this abortion. I agreed to go along with what I was told to go along with.
That's desperately sad. That's absolutely horrific.
There are reports that, I mean, the police, once they had heard that, yes, they did not care. Timothy Evans was a man who was pretty much semi-literate. He couldn't read, he couldn't write. His confession was written for him by a police officer. He couldn't read it. There's a reporter who's written numerous books on it who has actually read this confession, and it's written like a textbook out of a cop, a police sort of manual.
Yeah.
How it's phrased, and it's been read back to him, or a version of it has been read back to Timothy, and it's like, make your mark on this. He's done it, and then this confession is lauded around the place.
You don't have the wherewithal to be able to argue it or to be able to question it. You just sort of feel this overwhelming sense of fucking horror because your wife and your child have just died.
Your child are both dead.
Wow. So it's a really interesting element of the story, the Evans bit of it.
So he is completely railroaded into this confession, and yes, he did it, and no one is looking for any other possibilities.
But then look what happened. As I said, you know, just dig a little deeper, guys. Dig a little deeper. If you've got someone, you're not going to waste, tragically, you're not going to waste the resources, you're not going to waste the money it's going to take to actually spend a few more hours of of manpower to look into the background of someone who turned out to be a massive bloody serial killer. I mean, it's like, oh, you could have caught him earlier, you bastards.
You know, I think the context of the country at the time, this is late 40s, this is after war, the country is fucked.
Absolutely, they have no time.
There is no time, there is no money for anything. If they can get a quick conviction, get it over and done with, out of the press, sorted, that's what we're going to do.
We can't look at it in the same way that we would look at today with the endless resources. And even though, you know, a lot of the public services are stretched as well, we know. Compared to that time, it is horrific. At the same time, it just feels like a little bit of digging, couple more questions.
A few more questions, a few more people who weren't quite so willing to believe, yes, that's on paper, you said that, then absolutely, let's not ask any more questions.
Christie's motivations behind it, as we've said, is that obviously there's an element of the sexuality, the sexual assault, and were the conversations about his sexual performance, were those added in later? Because you find that with a lot of...
I don't know.
Serial killers, and it's true in some cases, and it's also, oh, I've read a book, and like, yeah, let's just pin that on him. It's like it's used in a kind of a derogatory sense.
I don't know, because it seems to be from the various reports and things that I've read that it stems back quite a way. There are even reports that when he was in school, he was conging it up Christie.
Jesus.
So from like school times, sort of.
We can see a pattern there.
So there's definitely a pattern, what people may have heard about this story. I don't know if it's referenced in the film at all, but there are references to him being a necrophiliac. He strenuously denied that, but there were reports that the various women had been violated after they had died as well. I don't think is actually true, but I certainly think he had difficulties performing sexually, which caused this rage.
Well, what do you think, people? Over to you, the famous gruesome story of 10 Rillington Place. A great story covered in many, many films and books and podcasts before, but what do you think of our take on it? And what do you think of the story and all of the people involved? Do you have thoughts? Do you have theories about the motivations, about what was happening with Evans? What was happening with all these women? What was going on there? That's what we need to solve, people. Yep. I mean, it's been solved, really, is the crime. A very interesting period in history as well, relating to capital punishment.
Yeah.
An area that sometimes I think about, maybe we should talk about. We should talk about Albert Pierpoint at some point. I'd love to do a piece on him.
Have you seen the film?
I have, Timothy Spall. Yes, absolutely. Yes, Annie interviewed Timothy Spall, actually, part of the promotion of the film. He's lovely. Very interesting period in history, and we, you know, always welcome thoughts on that. Jump on the comments of the social media channels that you follow about this episode. Jump on the comments of the episode on any of the channels where you're listening to this. Send us DMs, talk to your friends about it, converse about it over a glass of wine at your next dinner party. It will be a depressing dinner party, but it would also be a bit of, oh yes, actually we're really into true crime. Make sure that you are sharing the story of the poisonous cabinet with all and sundry, but most importantly, for a gruesome tale, do mix up a delightful lemonade number 10.
It is entirely delightful. I do feel that story needed something a bit more hefty.
It needed a spirit forward drink.
It did need a spirit forward drink, absolutely.
We had to go and get more wine because this was very upsetting, and the lemonade number 10, beautiful as it was, was not cutting shit.
It wasn't doing it for this story.
Wasn't steadying my nerves, cooled me down, yet I was shaking like, no.
So if you're listening to this on your summery veranda, then absolutely knock up lemonade number 10. The recipe will be out this evening. Get some blueberries. Give them a smash. Ooh. Chuck some rum in. Tasty, tasty.
And then mix up one of the spirit forward drinks when you listen to the story.
Mix up a Red Hook or something.
See how the evening degenerates. Make sure that you are following us on Patreon if you don't already. We have got some very exciting new tiers on Patreon coming out in July, which means a lot more content that we're going to be producing. If you have any questions about the Poisoner's Cabinet or the content that we produce, you can always drop us a DM. We do have a live chat on Patreon this weekend for Patreon subscribers, and we will also have some more YouTube content coming out very soon. Final shout out, the British Podcast Award nominations are out at the moment. Now, we would love it if you voted for the Poisonous Cabinet, but my drive is vote for Real Life Ghost Stories.
I agree.
In the Listener's Choice Awards, and if they win, They get a billboard in London. We want to see Real Life Ghost Stories. Absolutely. Billboard up there. Emma is a dear friend of ours. She puts a huge amount of work into that podcast. So guys, please, you can vote for us. But if you've only got one email address, whatever you have to do, save your vote. Vote for Real Life Ghost Stories. Let's get them that billboard. That
Hurrah.
Is a rallying cry, people.
Hurrah for M.
Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the poisoner's cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.